without having to place them on the payroll. The sponsoring agency would agree to pay, would agree prior to the academy to screen the applicants, as it normally does, and to sign an employment agreement to hire the individual upon successful completion of the course. The academy could also benefit from revenues by charging for room and board. This would be very similar to what other state-funded schools offer, yet still limit services and restrict enrollment. There has been a lot of talk about not allowing any individual to receive training, and I recognize the need for that. I recognize the need that we can employ these people as soon as they're out of academy. And it doesn't create another post, such as in California. I think that this is a compromise and a resolution to attempting to find a way to do RS and pay the wages. I would say that since 1981, we currently have 8 budgeted police officers. But any time on our monthly reports is given to City Council, it's always how many we're down and how many we're trying to recruit and how we're going to resolve it and how we're going to keep a full force, which results in overtime and other things. So we have other hidden costs associated with it. Today, and I always like to feel like there's a solution to a problem. And I always like to feel that things can be talked out in ways of doing things. I was accused, like I said, of opening a can of worms, which is, you talk to several past legislators, past police officers, past police chiefs, and they'll tell you about the same thing. But you talk to anybody from a small town that's a police chief, and they're going to tell you the same thing. They're also facing this type of problem. I'd like to have you direct the BPSST to consider this and other proposals that may help to keep the cost associated training down and report back to this committee at the next legislative session. That gives you plenty of time to look it over, to try to find a way to resolve this issue and try to reach a compromise on training costs. I guess that's my proposal. Are there any questions I can try to answer?
Representative Parker.
Thank you. You have trouble recruiting now. I think that would make it virtually impossible to tell somebody to go pay for your own training and we'll hire you. And I think that still wouldn't, just in looking at that, I haven't thought about this, but so I do that and I get hired by you and then Lincoln County offers me more or a better job or whatever, so then I bail anyway. I'm not sure, other than you not having to pay the salary, will that help?
Currently, Representative, when you're dishing out, and we've probably estimated that we spent easily $330,000, over the last few years training officers, we wouldn't have that loss in wages if they bail on us, which they're currently doing anyway. We do everything, like I said, possible to retain those officers. I think that we offer a fair package. In looking at the recruitment process, I think that every agency is facing problems today. Our workforce is getting older. Our enrollment in the schools are going down, in Lincoln County anyway. I don't know statewide, but I know that people that step forward that do want a career at the age of 21 have usually made up their minds. The stipulations for becoming a police officer, several of the applicants that we have had has had training at different universities, and they still have to attend the basic training, which is recognized. But I don't think it's going to be a deterrent to anybody stepping forward to train. I think when I went to school, when I went to college, it was expected of me to pay my salary. And there were several times there where, you didn't have very much money. But I think 4 months, not unusual to ask somebody to do it. The other possibility, like I said, in a compromised position, is maybe the county or the city could offer them a scholarship of some sort.
Mr. Chambers, we're going to have to get rolling because we have a lot of other folks and we have some questions up here.
Just have one follow-up.
Yeah,
just
sure.
A quick suggestion. My suggestion would be to consider getting into a compact with the other cities and counties. When I was in the state police in 1970, they would not hire somebody away until they'd been at least 2 years out of the academy. So just a thought there.
And Cameron and the Nathan, or I'm sorry, Nathan's and the Cameron, but I have one quick question. This is probably more of a policy bill than a budget item. Have you talked to your own state rep about trying to introduce legislation about this?
2 years ago, we introduced from the city of Toledo legislation. 2 years ago, it didn't get off the floor. 2 years ago, it was a different package.
Okay.
And I didn't want to follow the same approach. I feel like we can sit down and talk about it.
Okay, fair enough. Representative Nathanson, then Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Much of the discussion and the proposed solution is on the cost side, not necessarily recruitment, but costs of training, and there being several components to that. Following along the lines that Representative Barker just mentioned, thinking outside the box, you mentioned you were advised that you were opening a can of worms. Well, I'll open a can of worms here, too, but my background is in local government, and I certainly understand the difficulties of trying to figure out how things might work in a more coordinated a coordinated fashion among multiple jurisdictions, because every city is going to have a different set of municipal ordinances, and those are still different than what the county laws or ordinances might be. If it weren't for those differences, is there something outside the box, either such as what Representative Barker mentioned, a compact about not raiding. We used to call it raiding, not raiding someone else's staff. But is there anything else that you might consider? And in the interest of time, you don't have to answer today, but I would just suggest thinking more on how to solve the retention problem rather than the other parts of the problem. The fact that too many people are leaving too quickly, if it's about salary, if it's about lack of excitement or lack of interest. In other areas where it's less complicated, there are job sharing opportunities where you can be involved in other sorts of activities and maintain interest. Given the complexity of ordinances, maybe that sort of thing isn't possible to actually work for multiple jurisdictions. But what else could be done? I would just encourage you to think about what other solutions might exist on the retention side rather than the cost of training piece.
We're working under a small contract with the Confederated Tribes of Celeste to offer police protection to them also. So we're trying to retain officers by offering them a little bit more jurisdiction of which to handle. Plus, there's also a cooperative agreement with several of the agencies, such as the SWAT team or the drug team or whatever else. You know, there's several different opportunities there. The main thing is I think the lack of excitement in the small town. And when you talk to them why they're leaving, that's basically it.
Well, I commend you for the I commend you for the creativity. I wish you success, and I'll be interested to hear how it goes.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chambers, what was your position? I didn't catch that.
I'm a city councilor of the city of Toledo.
Okay. I just want to thank you for coming forward and laying out your challenges and your problems before this committee. I think it's great that you're asking for help, and I want to encourage you, because I thought, just as a normal business person here, as I understand how expensive it is to train people and then to lose them to the competition, that there ought to be some ways we can incentivize and reward them, and I hope you can come up with some creative solutions. And I'm not sure what prevents you from if you can find a way that you can go get somebody to go through training for free with an incentive that if they stay for so long, then you'll pay them a bonus or whatever. I don't know what those answers are, but certainly if you can find some people to help be creative, I think it's a great thing. And in our government, we need to find ways to be more creative to incentivize people to do a good job and to stay with us and to move forward. So I applaud your efforts to come forward, and if I can help you personally, let me know.
I thank you, and it's like I said, I don't feel like myself that I'm speaking for a small town of just one. I think if you went to Independence Monmouth, you'd probably find the same thing there, where Salem reaps the benefits of police officers. I think that it's not uncommon to see that, and there are other avenues there's ORSs that are currently in place. I don't mean to take up so much time, but I'll try to finish this up. ORS 181640 under 3A, which upon the request of a law enforcement unit or public safety agency, conduct surveys or aid cities and counties to conduct surveys through qualified public or private agencies and assist in the implementation of any recommendations resulting from such surveys. To me, this is an avenue for the BPSST to conduct surveys and look at the problems that's associated with small towns and to aid and help. And rather than to continue to say, we don't have any funds. But I do understand what you're saying, and I appreciate your offer.
Great, and I'm sure Mr. Minnis will be happy to respond on Monday. So we thank you very much for coming forward, Mr. Chambers. And I think what you've heard here is some sympathetic ears, that if you wanted to go meet with some of the reps or senators here, you might find somebody who could advocate for you.
I appreciate it. I hoping that we might be able to resolve some things. Maybe Mr. Minnis, Director Minnis, I could sit down and discuss things, but I would hope that the BPSST, the board, would be willing to accept this as a challenge.
Great. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you. Jim, I know you run a tight ship, but where this fellow Hanna comes from, they start him out with blanks, and then after 2 years, they give him more.
Where's Summers?
Thank you.
You're always so serious.
Mr. Burkett? Burright. And Mr. Harper? And should we just do those two? Yeah. And to make sure that we can get through everybody, if we can try to keep the testimony questions to about 5 minutes a person. Ready when you are. Please identify yourself.
Chair Shields, member of the committee. My name is Jim Harper. I'm the police chief of Dallas, Oregon. I'm also the past president of the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police, and I'm here today as a representative of Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police and 140 strong to endorse the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training's budget and talk about a little bit of some of the observations of what our association has seen as a true partnership with the Academy. Before I go on, introduction of... Okay, there you go. One thing I want to talk about, I provided written testimony from our association, and we wanted to talk a little bit about a couple things, and I'll be brief because I know that you have a lot of testimony today. One of the first items I wanted to briefly talk about has to do with the professional standards side of the police academy and what they have done in partnership with the chiefs and the sheriffs and now the Oregon State Police Department of Corrections. We've been able to promote the highest possible standards for all of public safety, including certification standards, physical fitness standards, and standards of conduct that have never been higher since I've been in my 30 years of law enforcement. And I tell you, in today's world, with all the complex issues that we're dealing with every day, it seems like when we get a call in the middle of the night and we're dealing with a mental health issue on one end and then a violent person on the other end, and we either have to be a person to deal with a physical situation or be a soft counselor on the other end. There's nothing more important than professional standards and training to help us promote that. We've been recently able to move our training from 8 weeks to 10 weeks, and now we're up to 16 weeks with the new academy opening. I know some of you have been able to go out and experience some of the scenario-based training. I also have had the honor of being an instructor involved in the academy, and each and every scenario that we look at, the curriculum has all been developed with a lot of input based on real-life situations. And I can tell you that when the officers leave the academy, they're at a higher level, able to deal with extremely intense situations. And that's what it's all about, putting an officer in an environment where they can actually learn and develop and then deal with it out on the street and in a safe environment. One of the other issues that the academy has been able to do as far as from the Chiefs Association is they've been a great example of communication to our association. They provided not only an excellent communication system back and forth between the association, but our members have personally been involved, and they promoted that all along the way. So our curriculum has been developed all across the board from all of our members in law enforcement and also members of the citizens at large to try to develop the best possible curriculum for all of law enforcement. And it's been especially enhanced with John Menace now as director. He's been able to keep moving the system in the right direction with his background in law enforcement, and he's been extremely easy to work with, and our association has been extremely pleased with his efforts.
Okay. Terry Shields, members of the committee. My name is Dave Burright. I'm the executive director for the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, and I before that time I was with the Linn County Sheriff's Office for about 29 years and was the sheriff for the last 10 and a half years of that time. Prior to me, my father was a police officer, and he started in the late 40s for a very short time with Flomath and then with the city of Corvallis, where he finished out his career. When he first was with Corvallis, he talked about the old days when, a hot shift was when one of the local frats pulled a panty raid on one of the sororities there at the university. You knew you had a call to go on when they lit the light that was strung across Main Street in Corvallis, because there were no portable radios or radios in the cars or anything back in those days. I started in the business in 1975, and when I was contemplating starting into this career, I clearly remember a discussion I had with Dad, and he was talking about how, he says, I support your decision. He says, but this is a very different world today than it was about 30 years prior when he had started in the business. He says, it's totally different. You wouldn't recognize the job today than it was back then. Well, when he retired in 79, we talked about that some, but then when I eventually retired in 2005, I also clearly remember they had a nice going away party, and Dad was sitting out in the audience. And as I was sitting there listening to people talk about things that had happened in years gone by, I remembered that conversation with him and thought to myself, it's happened again. In the time that I have been in this business from about 75, 76 up to that point, it has totally changed once again. With technology and the laws and what's required of a police officer, a public safety officer of all kinds, it is a totally, totally different world. And when Dad started, there was no basic police academy. Shortly thereafter, they started doing some, he said that we went to a lot of 1 and 2 day trainings and things, but then shortly thereafter, they went to Camp Withicum, and they were there for a week or two for the new recruits. Gradually over the years, we switched to Western Oregon State, College, university, And as Chief Harper mentioned, when I started, it was 8 weeks. And then it went to 10, and finally we're at 16. And it's a wonderful thing that we have, because the training that we have our officers has to keep up with the real world. As much as the profession has changed from the time when Dad was there and there was no training to the time now, we have to have that piece of training to make sure that our officers are trained to do what they need to do. I had a little, very small part in the development of the new academy and some of the buildings and where it would be. And I know that during those discussions, as this building was coming out of the ground, there was a lot of talk about, well, okay, you know, the buildings are one thing, but how are we going to staff it and how are we going to run it when it's all over? Because just like a lot of other businesses and jails and so forth that I'm familiar with, the building part is the cheap part in the long run. But I guess my message to you is that facility out there is really a crown jewel in Oregon's hat. It is a phenomenal place, but it is only a facility unless we are able to run it and staff it accordingly. And that's why I'm here. Obviously, I don't know every line in the DPSST budget, but I do know that it will take dedicated staff to run that facility the way it should be. And we are so pleased in the direction that it is going. I totally agree with Chief Harper that the things that we've seen happen out there and in the last 2 or 3 years have been great. We've seen a tremendous increase in the professionalism of not only the staff, but of the officers that are there. We've requested in this, and the DPSC staff have been great at working at ethics and instilling that in our officers and making sure they understand what's expected of them. The communication and there are requests for assistance have been outstanding. And another thing that has been wonderful, and we appreciate some assistance we got from the legislature, is the ability to have the Oregon State Police train with us. Great. That is a very positive step. So thank you for what you do, and we would just like you to know that we do support the DPSST budget.
Great. Make time for one question if anybody has one. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Appreciate your testimony. Next, Ms. Ingram. Mr. Fowler, and on deck is Mr. Prince. Ready when you are.
Chair Shields, Jenna Ingram, Executive Director of the Oregon Fire District Directors Association, representing approximately 250 districts across the state. They are managed by a board of five. Each one has a board of five elected officials like yourselves who set the budgets, hire the chief, purchase equipment, things of that nature. The fire service is wholeheartedly in support of the DPSST budget. As you might imagine, particularly for the small rural fire protection districts, training is our top priority, and the benefit that we derive from the DPSST. If we had a wish list, it would be to increase the number of trainers and those training opportunities for our small rural fire protection districts. Currently, right now, there are approximately 10,000 volunteer firefighters across the state. As you might imagine, there's also a high turnover when you have that number of volunteers. And as the first witness indicated, many times, even though they're volunteers, they go through the process of being trained, and then there's a high volume of turnover, and there's always that demand for increased training that we just wholeheartedly want to support. Additionally, the fire district directors themselves have indicated to the DPSST that they would like to see a level of training for the directors, even though they aren't out there fighting the fires themselves. There's a real need. We conducted a survey at our conference year before last. I'm so sorry.
That's okay.
We did conduct a survey of our directors' conference before last, and they indicated that they would like to have training in the area of conflagration and other related policies dealing with the fire service. And we have had conversations, dialogue with the DPSST and the Fire Marshal's Office to make that happen and to increase training, not just for the volunteers, but for the directors who manage the those districts as well. So once again, we appreciate Director Minnis, how he has reached out to the fire service. Even though he comes from law enforcement, he's made sure to include the fire service as a priority. He has been very good about attending our conferences and responding to questions and concerns that the fire service has had, and we just wholeheartedly support the budget. I thank you.
Thanks. Chair Shields, distinguished committee members, good afternoon. My name is John Fowler, and I'm the fire chief of the city of Pendleton, home of Senator Nelson. I'm also the current president of the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association. As Ms. Ingram has already indicated, and there are others behind me that will speak in regards to the fire service support of this, I'm here to speak on behalf of the Oregon Fire Chiefs and to let you know that we thoroughly support the budget that's before you and the job that DPSST does for us as your Oregon Fire Service. As Genoa indicated, much of our constituency, much of our employees or volunteer staff are in fact volunteer. And on the east side of the state, maybe more so than others, although we would certainly not propose that we're more important than the west side. And east doesn't start at the Cascades, by the way. It's a little further than that. But I can tell you that I think the east part of the state share some particular concerns or burdens in terms of delivery of training services and the services that the DPSST has provided, the mentorship, the partnership, the roles they play in those communities, both past, present, and future in terms of the success of the Oregon Fire Service, is one that we support. They truly have become partners with the fire service. I appreciate Director Minnis and all of his staff. We're fortunate to have one of the regional trainers in our area, and in fact, he's one of my reserve firefighters. And this particular individual has 30 or 40 some years in the fire service, and he's come from a volunteer background. He's been a paid training chief. He's been a paid fire chief. And the things that he brings to the table, not just in terms of training, but in terms of overall fire department performance, is invaluable to the organizations on the east side of the state. And I would submit that occurs in every region within the state due to the efforts of the DPSST staff. So we thoroughly support what they're doing. And in fact, as you're well aware, fire training and certification is funded by the fire insurance premium tax, and we know that there's some discussion as to the role of that tax. We would certainly encourage you to protect the current places that funding is distributed to, and in fact, if there is additional opportunity to increase services with respect to training, we would encourage you to take a look at those opportunities. A couple of examples that this agency already provides is what we call the FLAG training. FLAG is an acronym for flammable liquids and gas. It's a trailer that the DPSST staff brings into a region and provides 12 to 16 hours of training that most agencies, including the city of Pendleton, do not have the ability to deliver in our region without that asset. A new asset that's been purchased is the Live Fire Training Trailer, which again will bring that asset into local communities to allow firefighters to actually get some hands-on experience, feeling the heat and dealing with the potential fears that new firefighters have in confronting that. We don't get the number of house fires or structure fires that we have in the past. That's a good thing. We also don't have the opportunity to burn, as we call a burn-to-learn opportunity, take a house that's going to be razed and actually burn it for training because of a variety of environmental issues. This new asset will bring opportunity to local communities that heretofore has not existed. I would encourage you to support this budget, and I would be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Senator Nelson.
I just have to make a public thank you to the good Chief Fowler, because I tried to burn up the city of Pendleton, and he saved me from myself. I was burning out in a field, and it jumped onto another stubble field, and the wind was blowing right towards Pendleton, and the fire department came out and probably saved my life, because I was trying to put it out. I was having a hard time.
That was an afterthought.
I do appreciate it, and they do great work.
Thank you.
I didn't want Senator Wessler to know that, because he'll never let me forget it now.
Serious comment.
Senator Wessler.
I just want to thank you both for your work during the interim. We had some very interesting emergency board discussions right in this very room, and I appreciate your perspective with regard to purposes of the tax. And I know it's a discussion, but I just really want to thank you for your efforts over that interim.
Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you.
And for those of us who believe that east side of Oregon begins at the Willamette River, side, we also want to thank you for your work as well. Representative Hanna, did you have a comment? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, Mr. Prince, and let's see, Mr. Brian. Good.
Goodman.
Good. If you could please come up too. Oh, all right. Okay, great. And Mr. Prince, ready when you are.
Chairman Shields and members of the committee, my name is Mark Prince, and I am a battalion chief of the City of Hillsborough Fire Department. I too serve on as a director for the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association. And with that position, it also affords me the opportunity to serve at your will with the Board of Public Safety Standards and Training, and as well the Oregon's Fire Service Policy Committee. I'd like to take a brief moment to thank you for allowing me to speak to you here today in regards to the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training budget. My goal here today is to hopefully successfully encourage you to support the funding for the state fire training program that is currently being provided. Your commitment of providing an enhanced level of technical training to the men and women of Oregon's fire service has been emphasized more than 4 years ago with your approval to construct the newly developed state-of-the-art Public Safety Academy. This reality now hosts an opportunity and provides the fire service with a solid training platform to which we can train and become more efficient with the jobs that we're expected to perform. In my 10 years as a board member with BPST, Director Minnis and his staff have gone out of their way to work feverishly in accommodating the dynamic training needs of Oregon firefighters and ensure that the professional standards that we establish are obtained. Standards designed to meet the ever-increasing demands being placed upon both volunteer and career firefighters throughout the state of Oregon, it has become more apparent that in recent years that DPSST has undoubtedly strived to build stronger partnerships with our Oregon Fire Service constituents. These actions continue to raise the bar of excellence, and they increase our level of professionalism. And this movement is recognized nationwide. Please allow me to take just a couple of minutes to illustrate how the collaborative efforts of DPSST have benefited the Oregon Fire Service. In September 2005, DPSST, with the facilitation of Portland State University's leadership program, initiated a strategic planning process and engaged its public and private partners in a challenge to answer three basic questions, some of you which you may already know. What is DPSST doing well? What could it improve upon? And what programs or services does DPSST not currently provide today but should consider in the future? This challenge was stimulated the input and of other fire service professionals and stakeholders who were comprised of representatives actively functioning on that board. The representatives include members from the Oregon Department of Forestry, the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association, Portland Fire and Rescue, Oregon State Firefighters Council, Oregon Volunteer Firefighters Association, the district directors, as well as the Office of State Fire Marshal. As a result of this collaborative effort, the DPSST stakeholders identified and listed the deficiencies, some 50, that we opted or identified as being areas of improvement. And I would like to give you a couple of examples in relation to those. Streamlining personnel certification and accreditation. Currently, every application received by DPSST is in a hard copy format. There is no electronic means of conveying that information. And to ensure customer service, the DPSST staff spends an inordinate amount of time reviewing the applications for accuracy, conducting individual agency contact, seeking additional information, and addressing a myriad of other issues is routine follow-up. This results in an average turnaround time of 2 to 4 weeks. Keep in mind that 80% of Oregon firefighters are volunteers. This fact in itself can create additional challenges for the staff and members, since many of these departments do not have dedicated funding or individuals to manage their paperwork process. The focus of streamlining the accreditation and the development of electronic application, we believe, would reduce the margin of error, increase your staff's efficiency and productivity, and eliminate the risk of documentation being lost or misplaced. Number two is the enhancement of the regional training opportunities, as you have previously heard. The regional training provided by DPSSD continues to be a huge success when time and scheduling allows for that delivery of request courses can occur. Your fire training staff at DPSSD endeavors to provide the regional training as often as possible in effort to meet the needs of municipal and rural fire protection districts in all areas of the state. However, the class requests continue to exceed the small number of DPSSD instructors availability, and oftentimes it is often difficult to, or if not impossible, to coordinate or manage these training events. This often leaves the agency involved very frustrated and dissatisfied with the services expected of DPSSD. Most of you realize, again, as I stated, that volunteering as a firefighter is a time sacrifice that we continually recognize the numerous hours dedicated to the training and drilling in order to maintain our technical competence in providing emergency response to the people who live in frontier, rural, and urban areas. I dutifully ask that, if possible, your funding of this program too is a critical mission of DPSSD, continue and expand and grow in order to meet those needs. And the last one that I would like to throw out is, as budget constraints continue to squeeze local governments, training budgets are typically the first to be targeted and are one of the first operational programs to feel the effect of fiscal impacts. All the while, requests for all hazard emergency responses continue to increase. Fire training at DPSST needs to remain a priority, and we are presently sitting in an opportune juncture, a juncture that would easily support a state fire training academy. The successful concept being utilized in our state to the north. The academy concept could implement cost-sharing ideas, encourage interagency cooperation between DPSST and local fire jurisdictions, and provide a cost-effective basic means of providing advanced training opportunities. I could go on, but I'm sure you probably get the idea. And in closing, I would like to say the concepts proposed, if achieved, will positively impact the service that we together provide day in, day out, and ensure the completion of the mission for DPSST. The dynamics of our emergency preparedness and training have broadened significantly over the past 5 to 7 years for reasons we're all aware of, and DPSST's fire training program are essential in ensuring life safety of our firefighters and the public we serve. We have to address the hazards of all risk, including floods, fires, earthquakes, and structural collapse. DPSST's fire training mission will maintain that standard of focus and assure that the competency benchmarks are outlined and legitimately achieved. The new Public Safety Academy is only the beginning. You have provided much of the hardware needed in order to achieve the success, and now I'm asking that you provide and support the funding to put those tools in motion.
Great. Any questions? Thank you, Mr. Prince.
Thank you. I'll take my book and leave.
Mr. Goodman and Mr. Lashford.
Good afternoon. For the record, Brian Gleichman. I'm here representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations and the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees. What's being passed out to you today are the policy elements of two bills that we're asking to have introduced this session. The reason why I wanted to bring this up at this point is because we believe both have at least some impact on the budget of the department, and we wanted to alert you enough in advance so you didn't get surprised at some point down the road. Let me start by saying that both of the organizations support the budget of the department. The issue for us is not whether or not the facility is correct, whether or not it's adequately staffed. But we do have two concerns that I would like to just very quickly mention to you, and you can kind of put them in your hip pocket for future considerations. Of the two bills, let me first talk about the composition of the board. You may or may not be aware that the current composition of the board is 24 members. I cannot imagine a board of any state agency, department, volunteer board in which you have 24 members. It's far too large. It goes back a number of years to everybody wanting to have a piece of the pie, and DPSSD does a number of different things. But the first bill that we're introducing would reduce that membership down to 17. I don't know that it has a substantial impact on the budget because most of those folks are getting paid by their employer for showing up, but it may, in fact, have some minor implications in the budget of the department. The second and perhaps more important bill that we're introducing is a bill that I've heard a need for a number of years, and that's a alteration or change in the due process procedures in the hearing process of revocations of certifications at the department. I first became aware of this issue about 6 years ago. We attempted to deal with that by adding one additional line staff to each of the fire policy subcommittee, the Corrections Policy Subcommittee, and the Police Policy Subcommittee, hoping that with a little more input from the line staff that their procedures as far as how they deal with officers from all those disciplines would in fact be altered. It appears that that is not the case. And so the second bill that we've introduced alters the process for hearings of in revocation of certifications so that in fact the officer has the ability to appear at a hearing. They have the ability to interact and answer questions if brought up from either the policy subcommittee or the board, which they do not at this present time. And we would also ask that the first step in this process be an open hearing in which there be an administrative law judge that actually has a finding of fact as to whether or not the officer and the case was made by the DPSS staff in the revocation itself. So with that, let me just close by saying I hear over and over and over again from all the disciplines that I represent, corrections, parole and probation, and the line officers, police officers, that none of these officers wants to have a process in which it's protecting those officers that they believe truly should not be in the business. That's not what this is all about. What we're talking about here is a process in which they, in fact, have the opportunity to have a fair and just hearing in front of the board, and that's the crux of it. Those two bills are in final drafting right now and will be out relatively soon. And with that, I'll turn it over to Brian Goodman. Thank you.
Mr. Goodman.
How are you doing, Chip Shields, and committee members? My name is Brian Goodman. I'm a corporal. I work for the Department of Corrections at Oregon State Correctional Institute. I have been working there for 10 years, what he said. But in addition, I would like to bring up one issue that is an ongoing issue with the Department of Corrections, county corrections, and parole and probation. One of the gentlemen that testified here just a few minutes ago was really happy that basic police went from 8 weeks to 10 weeks to 16 weeks. This training concentrates on police and its procedures and training. The Department of Corrections, when I came in 10 years ago, I had 5 weeks. 10 years before that, there wasn't any formal training for correctional officers. Now we're in the year 2007. And also the Department of Corrections and its makeup of inmates has drastically changed. Now you've got an element of gangs. You've got more CTS. You've got an older population.
Explain what CTS is.
It's counselor treatment services. More mentally ill inmates are coming into the system. I also sit on the policy committee for DPSST, and one of the issues that came up between all three disciplines, since we only have a short time to learn our discipline, is the separation of parole and probation, county corrections, and also the Department of Corrections, because we all actually have very different jobs from each other. But when you're trying to squeeze all three disciplines into 5 weeks, it makes it very difficult for that employee to go back and really say with a certainty that he knows his job. And in general, when we do get a new employee back into the Department of Corrections, I would say that he knows about 30% of the job. He doesn't really go over the rules, the policies, or the procedures of the department. It is a basic training. The department also recently, within the last few years, instituted what's called the Oregon Accountability Model, which is a more defined system on holding inmates accountable through role modeling, reinforcement, redirecting of its inmate population. It has had somewhat of a positive effect, but this is other training that needs to be given at the basic level. So with that, I don't want to take up too much of your time, but I would urge Mr. Minnis to seriously consider that at some point that these disciplines do be separated and that all three be given 5 weeks, since we've asked for more weeks of training to incorporate all the necessary training that we need to at least give the training in that separate discipline. So,
any questions for Mr. Goodman or Mr. DeLashmit? Mr. Wesley.
A couple for Mr. DeLashmit and then one for Mr. Goodman. Brian, I know you're very supportive of this budget, as everyone in the room is, and I know there are certain areas of policy that that good people can differ on, but you brought up, I think, a very interesting area when it comes to the very serious issue of decertification. We're talking about the integrity of the disciplines and the profession and the capacity to do the work, but we're also talking about individuals, human beings, their families, their livelihood. And so I guess my first question is really a due process question in terms of how this works. Do these officers have access to complaints prior to the point of a hearing, so they have a written understanding, a formal presentation of what is going on?
Mr. Chair, Senator Westland, it's my understanding that they do, in fact, they are given the charges that are being leveled against them. What they don't have access to is all the background or investigative information that, in fact, anyone in any court of law would have access to in order to make an argument on their own behalf. The other piece that we find interesting is that in the other boards that I'm familiar with, whether it's Board of Nursing or whatever, the nurse gets to appear and gets to actually interact. If there's a question by a board member or a policy subcommittee member, they can ask for some clarification on the statement that they were going to make. And in this case, the person has a complaint against them can offer a written statement, but then doesn't get to have interaction with the policy subcommittee that it's going to take action against them or potentially take action against them. So,
well, do they have representation in the hearing room? I'm not sure I understood what I just heard in terms of they're not even there. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Westland, it's my understanding that they do not have the ability to have an attorney in the room that's representing their interests and has the ability to review those documents or make a counterstatement.
These are discussions for lengthier times, and I'd be interested in looking at your bills, but I have a very serious question for Mr. Goodman.
Fire away.
You still have your Firebird?
Yes, Senator Westland, I do.
For the record, he's got the coolest Firebird in Oregon. I'm just saying that.
On the hearings, then, I didn't realize that an officer couldn't actually appear. Can you have witnesses go in and testify on their behalf? Or?
Chair Shields, Representative Barker, and you have a policy subcommittee member here. Maybe he can follow up on that. It's my understanding that they can be present. They're very seldom encouraged to be present. But they do not get to interact. So it makes very little difference if they're sitting in the room and somebody's talking about them, and they may have information that may in fact alter the determination, and they have no ability to do so.
And you have policy bills that are addressing this issue, is that correct?
I do.
Okay, yeah. Good. Thank you. Any other questions?
Take it up, I guess, when we get to policy, someplace else.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Yeah, Mr. Osborne, were you here to testify? Okay. Would anybody else like to testify? Well, Senator Minnis, would you like to begin your testimony from next time? Since I've snatched away a half hour that the committee just thought that they had gathered, how about we do 15 minutes and we'll let everybody out a little bit early?
Mr. Chairman, I just want to say I don't know. I'm surprised that people keep saying, well, Mr. Minnis is kind to the fire service. He's always told me he liked the hose draggers, so I don't know why they think otherwise.
And colleagues, Mr. Minnis brought some information that you have at your desk. One thing that I wanted to call your attention to is he broke down the cost of training for law enforcement, for corrections training, parole and probation, et cetera. And so with costs of about close to $7,500 in corrections training, and I think there are 500 new FTEs in the Department of Corrections. I'm sure not all of those are correctional officers, but it's just another way sometimes that the growing corrections budget might affect other budgets as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the Public Safety Subcommittee. With respect to public testimony, I heard quite a few questions and maybe some issues that need to be resolved. And so we'll try to do a swag and pull as much of that together as we can in a salient document so you can have some sense for what our response might be to some of the issues that were raised today. With that, I'll begin my presentation again, beginning on page 18 of the handouts that were given to you. On Tuesday, we'll just jump right into it. The administration, the agency, and the director's office, we have 5 FTE. Human resources has 6.71. Information services has 7. And business services division has 10 FTE. And we can get into later if you want regarding specifically what those functions might be. Now moving to performance overview, performance measures, which I understand is a key interest of the committee. I'm going to begin on page 20. We're going to talk about key performance measure number 1, which is described as the level of officer performance as determined by the employing agency after successful completion of basic training. You can see our targets in 2005 and 2006 on a scale of 1 to 7 were 4. Our actual results from surveys were 4.22 and 4.23. Our proposed target for 2007 is also 4. It's footnoted that the target will be set higher with implementation of 16-week basic police course. It's also noted that this performance measure is actually derived from about 20 different data collection points that attempts to evaluate a number of areas, including the officer's attitude, officer safety, problem-solving skills, driving skills, performance skills, stress, non-stress situations, knowledge of criminal statutes in general, and then also criminal procedure, managing conflicts, investigative skills, relationships with the community, inmates, ethnicities other than the officers in particular, and then also report writing skills, organization and detail, and so on and so forth. With respect to performance measure number 2, this is a measure that is described as the percentage of attendees who rank the usefulness of DPSST regional training. Again, the targets here, 2005 was 70%, 2006, 75%. Our actuals in 2005, 90%, 2006, 91%. Again, our target in 2007 is 75%. The various factors here, satisfaction with the DPSST regional training is high. I testified to that earlier, and I think the listening tours and other surveys and face-to-face conversations and various interaction with our constituents has demonstrated that that's the case.
Yes. Senator Brown had a question.
Sorry.
Thank you, and you're like talking very fast, so I don't know whether I should interrupt you. So my question is here, if you're exceeding your target by 20%, at least you did the prior 2 years. Why aren't you making your target harder as opposed to easier when you're exceeding it on this performance measure?
Well, that, Mr. Chairman and Senator Brown, that's an excellent question. I don't know the answer to that question. I think I'll kind of throw the football in my partner here.
Thank you. Chair Shields, Senator Brown, it's a good question. And actually, our entire KPM or quality assurance process is under review. We agree with your comment that, that if we're constantly at 90, why are we still at 75? So we're actually looking at all of our KPMs and all of our other data collection points to really ratchet them up higher to be realistic to where we're trying to be as an organization. So it's a good point.
And, Mr. Chairman, Senator, one of the issues is that we are in a major transition with respect to the curriculum and how the curriculum is being viewed. So I think, quite frankly, we're not sure what the outcomes might be as we move into the more complex scenario-based training. In addition,
Chair Shields and Senator Brown, one of the things that, that we have in our proposed KPMs for 07-09 is that in 2008 we moved to 85%, and in 2009 we'll be at 90% for KPM, if that maybe gets at our question. But then again, we could also push that forward, and that's one of the discussions we're having. Maybe that's not – that's too far into the future.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Could you identify yourself for the record, too?
Are you? Chair Shields, members of the committee, Eric Gablix. I'm the deputy director at the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training.
Mr. Chairman, I'm John Minnis, the director of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. I think I failed to mention my own name. Going back to factors, the highest-ranked courses tend to be those that involve hands-on training, such as firearms, active shooter, range 3000, defense tactics, and emergency vehicle operations. Again, this is the area of training that involves perishable skills and a need to continue to refresh officers' fine motor skills and also motor muscle memory, because these kind of actions generally occur under stress when the person's mind tends not to function very well. Our comparators are the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center in Glencoe, Georgia, which is probably the largest training center in the United States. They train most of the federal law enforcement officers in the United States. Their standard is 58% of their participants' rate. Their training is acceptable or higher, so we are exceeding that and hope to continue to exceed those results. I'll switch now, if I can, to KPM or key performance measure number 3, the percentage of attendees who ranked the usefulness of DPSST fire training targets 2005, and it was 70%, 2006, 75. Our actuals were, again, 85 and 91. And I think, Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, you might see the same issue popping up here. Target is 2007 is 75. And I'll turn to my...
It's the same.
And again, okay, we're looking at raising. All right, and then the factors in this case with fire is the satisfaction with DPSST fire training is high. I think you heard some earlier testimony to that effect. Two additional fire training coordinators were hired during the last biennium. The Baker City Field Office has been established in the eastern portion of the state. And quite frankly, from my own experience, I don't think I realized this until I took this position, but there is a substantial, I guess identity that exists between Central Oregon and Eastern Oregon and the Willamette Valley, and it's an important factor that has to be taken in as the agency communicates and addresses the various issues that we find in local communities. The issues we find perhaps in Baker City are not the same ones we'll find in the metropolitan Portland area, so the agency's done quite a bit to try to reach out to those communities. The implementation of fire safety and survival training programs, such as Mayday, that complement the national Everyone Goes Home initiative. And I'm going to switch over to Eric's, if I can, since he's a firefighter, and just touch on those two issues, if you can.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, for the record, Eric Gablix from DPSST staff. The issue here is that nationally, unfortunately, we continue to lose over 100 firefighters in the line of duty each year nationwide. What the National Fire Service Organizations, the firefighters, the volunteer firefighters, the fire chiefs, have done is really entered into a partnership, if you will, to try to mitigate and minimize the number of line-of-duty deaths through a number of initiatives that do that. One of the ones that was identified that we embraced right away is to train firefighters to call for help when they realize they need help. rather than getting into trouble. And it really takes off from what the military has done for a number of years, which is training pilots to recognize when they're in a problem in a jet plane. We have developed that training. We take it out across the state. And what it really does is to let firefighters call for help when they know they're going to need it. And it really gets away from the machoism, if you will, of, I think I can get out of this situation where I'm in a building where wires fall down, I'm in all of my protective equipment, and I know I have 15 minutes of air left. And then I call for help when my bell goes off telling me I'm almost out of air. So what we've really done is said, no, call for help when you need help, before that danger alarm triggers in. So that's what we're doing there with the Mayday program. And, again, it's one of 16 initiatives nationally. And really the idea there is that everybody goes home, meaning that we come to work with as career volunteer firefighters, but at the end of the shift, the end of the call, we're able to go back to our families. So we're trying to do our part to make sure that that's possible.
Mr. Chairman, members, I knew that Eric's could explain that much better than I could, being a firefighter. But the comparator with respect to this KPM is the National Fire Academy standard is 90% of participants rate their on-campus and field delivery programs as acceptable or higher. We are close to that. I guess we exceeded it in 2006. And one comment associated in the notes is the implementation of the 53-foot mobile tire training unit and increased program offerings by the department will increase outreach efforts. And some of the authorizations we've had for capital outlay for some of these types of props are really fairly large investments, but they're going to be traveling around the state and be used substantially among volunteer firefighting units around the state, and I think will prove to be a substantial benefit to the organizations. I'm going to try to keep my promise here. I've got 2.5 minutes. If I can, KPM number 4 is the percentage of revocation or denials upheld at the appellate level. At the appellate level, the target is 100% in 2005, 2006. Our actuals is 2005 and 2006 is 100%. And 2007, our goal is 100%.
Excuse me, Mr. Mendes, what is the appellate level? What does that consist of?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Barker, this would be at the Court of Appeals level or the Supreme Court level.
Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Senator Wesley.
Director Mendes, 100%. What's that number? I mean, you have those numbers for 2005. I mean, how many went to the appellate level and were upheld?
Mr. Chairman, I do not have those. Senator Wesley, I don't have those with me, but we will get those for you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Mr. Chair, I think my on these target levels, when your target is 100% and you're meeting it regularly, I think that the underlying performance measure is we're missing the point here, I think. So I just would add this into my other concerns about that I raised earlier.
Probably to 110.
Thank you, Senator Westland. I think that sort of defeats the purpose of the performance measure.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Brown, the agency would agree with you, and I think one of the things that we'll say is that we are evaluating and having ongoing discussions with the Oregon Progress Board. And in addition to the discussions with the Oregon Progress Board, the direction of that board internally, looking at internal key performance measures as we now develop processes and programs within the new academy with the new curriculum. So we're dogging it, basically.
Mr. Chair, and I'm assuming this is the same issue that Mr. DeLashmit raised earlier, that you're winning your appeals when there's no evidence been able to given by the... No? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, the documents and the information I'll provide for you on Monday will refute the vast majority of everything
okay.
that
All
Mr.
Right.
DeLashmit...
Thank you. Mr. Chair, for the record, I just say it's easier to win an appeal if the other side's not being able to give any evidence. So,
Mr. Chairman and Senator Brown, I don't believe that the appellate courts would allow us to get away with that.
Okay.
Real quickly, before you jump back in, Mr. Minnis, does your agency or does someone at the state level track police fatalities statewide? Is that something that you can get data on?
Mr. Chairman, I believe police officer fatalities or it would be the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and I believe that the International Association of Chiefs of Police also track some numbers. There's probably some other ancillary numbers in terms of felonious assaults on police officers that perhaps don't result in the death of the officer.
Because, you know, when I went to visit your great facility, I mean, one of the things that I really saw in the training is that you're giving people as close to real-life scenarios as possible, and if there's a way that we could track your effect, even if it's, you know, obviously not a cause and effect that you didn't absolutely 100% prevent those deaths, but it might just be something that would bolster your case.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, there's a substantial body of research and information papers on this very subject. It's extremely complex, and we'll try to pick some of the more salient studies that we can find for you. In fact, I think the book that I loaned to you loaned to the committee dealing with it's titled How Police Officers Live and Why They Die by Dr. Blum cites some of those issues, and you might find some reference notes and footnotes in that book that might also kind of elucidate the entire discussion. I'm beyond my time, Mr.
Mr. Chair, do you want these passed out? We wanted to make sure.
Yes.
It's up to the chair, Mr.
Yes, please.
And they are on loan to members. The members of the Senate can probably keep them. The House has to give them back at the end of their term, according to the chief clerk, and I did check, so.
Great. Are we in a decent place to end, Mr. Minnis?
Mr. Chairman, whenever you tell me to be quiet, that's exactly when I...
Well, I would never tell you to be quiet, but I might tell you that we should perhaps conclude, unless people have some questions right now. Representative Nicholson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was jumping ahead, so maybe we could hear an answer some other day. I was looking at key performance measure number 7, accessible and accurate records. May I ask a question about number 7? I wanted to know what kind of records this is and what is the impact on public safety or the public at large.
Mr. Chairman, just quickly, we'll try to respond in paper in a little bit more detail, but a lot of these records are the officers' actual training records, and the reason that those are important is oftentimes when a police officer testifies in court, both the prosecutor and the defense attorney will subpoena those records because it will make a difference in terms of the qualifications or the ability of the defense to impeach the officer's credibility on the stand.
Or enhance.
Or enhance, correct, exactly.
I see. Yeah, thank you. That's satisfactory. That answers the question.
Okay. Well, why don't we take a break here? We'll give the members the 15 minutes free time, and we will look forward to seeing you on Monday. And this committee is adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.